Beginning, just a third lecture, but just to tell you again, this course has three parts. There's the mathematics of differential geometry, then the second part is general relativity, the third part is cosmology. Basically, the first part, the differential geometry part, is not going to be featuring in any examination or anything that leads to grades, except when we get into curvature. And then general relativity and curvature, this is going to be the subject of the essay. And then cosmology is going to be the subject of the project. And the grades will be based on just the essay and the project. No midterm, no final. No homework either. Even though I give you a little homework today, but you don't have to hand that in. It's just something for you to play with. OK, so this is where we are at the moment. Now, we were discussing the notion of tangent space. And we said that there are three ways to define what a tangent space is. Oh, thank you. That's good. There are three ways to define what a tangent space is. There's the algebraic, modern way to do it. There's the physicist's way that you may have seen before. And then there's the geometric way, which is most intuitive. So today, we'll do the physicist's way and the geometric way of defining the tangent space, since we already completed the algebraic definition last time. OK, so what is then the physicist's definition of the tangent space? The definition that, for example, Einstein would have used. Maybe not in the exact way that we look at it now, but essentially, that's what he did. So let's remember what we did here. We said we have an abstract differentiable manifold, M, and we've singled out a point, P. We're interested in a tangent space to that point, right? So, but first of all, we have an abstract differentiable manifold M, and we single out some point P. Then, how can we talk about the manifold here? We do this by using a chart to make things concrete. So the chart maps the points of the manifold into points in Rn, and that's great because the points in Rn are just given by n tuples of numbers, so it's all very concrete. So in particular, the point P on the abstract manifold is mapped into a point Q in Rn, which can be explicitly pinpointed by giving n numbers, the coefficients in the basis of Rn. Then we said, OK, here's the differentiable manifold. And then here we singled out a point P. And then we are looking at the algebra of function germs around the point P. That's an algebra associated to the point P there, algebra of function germs. And F could be any choice of a function germ around this point P. Similarly, here we have Rn, which is also a differentiable manifold. And here we have the point Q. And we can consider the algebra of function germs, thanks, Turner, the algebra of function germs around the point Q. And that algebra we denote with f of Q. And G is some element of the algebra of function germs about the point Q. Then, as we saw last time, having a chart which maps these points into these points induces having a map from the algebra of function germs here to the algebra of function germs there. How do we do that? Well, a function germ here lives on this manifold. So it takes as input points, and as output, it will give you the values of the function. Now, if you prepend the chart, then your function germ now takes inputs over here, right? Because you take points here, map them over there, and then plug them into the function germ. This turns the function germ effectively into a function germ over here. So therefore, any function germ here is now mapped into a function germ over there. So that's a so-called pullback map here that we call phi star. It's an algebra homomorphism. Algebra homomorphism means that it doesn't matter whether you first multiply or add two function germs here and then map the result over there, or you map them first and then multiply them. Homomorphism always means it's a map that respects the structure. Morphism means structure. That respects the structure that we are mapping from and into. Okay, so now we have that the chart induces this algebra homomorphism. But then next we looked at the linear maps from the algebra function germs into the real numbers, which obey the Leibniz rule, the product rule for derivatives. These were what we called the tangent vectors, according to the algebraic definition. So algebraically, the tangent vectors are linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule, linear maps from the algebra function germs into the real numbers. And there, we now have a map that is induced from this algebra homomorphism, but it again goes the other direction, exactly for the same reason that we also had a change of direction over here. Okay, and this map now is a linear map. It's a linear tangent map. It is also homomorphism, but in this case, it's a vector space homomorphism. A vector space homomorphism is also called a linear map. It's the same thing, because all it has to respect is the linear structure of the vector space. All right, so that's what we had so far. And as far as the notation is concerned, phi was the map from P into Q, from the manifold into Rn. And it induced algebra homomorphism phi star. And we can write phi star as the concatenation of first phi, and then you apply the function germ. So it's phi and then g. That gives you the phi star. And then similarly here, the tangent map is induced in the same way. So the tangent map is you apply phi star to get from here to here, and then you can apply the tangent vector. That's phi star, and then afterwards xi. So the output of phi star is fed as input into xi. Remember, this is what this little circle means. It just concatenate two maps. You apply one map after the other. Okay, so phi star is then the pullback map of phi. And TP of phi, the tangent map, is the pullback of phi star. Okay, so what we have is, let's just go back. Remember that this picture is exactly true the same way if this is not Rn, but some other differentiable manifold. But there is a reason why we often want this to be Rn. And the reason is, as we said before, every point now acquires a name in terms of an n-tuple of numbers. But also every function germ that is pretty abstract over here becomes a very concrete function germ over Rn, made out of concrete functions over Rn. And similarly, the tangent vectors become very concrete tangent vectors, or they're being mapped into very concrete tangent vectors over a point in Rn. And again, we can give those as n-tuples. So just like the points of the manifold acquire names through the chart, also the tangent vectors in the abstract tangent space acquire what you may call names or labels or a concrete representation in terms of their image in the tangent space to the point in Rn. I'm a bit fuzzy about these things because later on, and often in the literature, people don't even think about it anymore. And they say, this is a tangent vector, and that is this, and this is that, when really they mean we are talking about the right-hand side. But you have to be careful because the abstract stuff, the physical stuff, is always over here, the stuff that we can actually work with because it's concrete numbers is over there. Okay, so every point in the manifold has now a concrete image. Every point P in the manifold has a concrete image Q in Rn. So it has coordinates, and every function germ over the abstract manifold is the image of a concrete function germ around a point in Rn. And every tangent vector to every abstract tangent vector in an abstract tangent space to an abstract point of the abstract manifold has now a concrete image as a tangent vector to a concrete tangent vector space to a point in Rn. And we do know what form these guys take, because we worked out how the tangent space does look like to a point in Rn. Namely, every tangent vector, remember, tangent vector so far for us is a linear map obeying the product rule. Every tangent vector takes this form. All of the linear maps obeying the Leibniz rule take this form, as we proved last time. And these are the coefficients that single out the direction in which we do this directional derivative. Now, what happens if we change coordinates? And again, there is something that is often skipped in the literature. Usually when we think we change coordinates, well, we just jump from one coordinate system to the other. But what's really going on is what is shown in this picture, namely that we have an abstract differentiable manifold which is supposed to describe the physics of it, space-time. And then from that abstract differentiable manifold, we have a chart into Rn, as usual, as we discussed up there. So all the points here get names in Rn, because every point here is mapped into a point in Rn. But we can also consider a different chart that maps the manifold into Rn, but it's a different map. It's a different chart. So now these points are mapped into different n-tuples, different numbers. This is what we mean by having a different coordinate system. And then if we switch from one coordinate system to the other, if we ask, I know the point P according to this coordinate system. I want to know what are its coordinates in that coordinate system with respect to that chart. Then really what I have to do is the inverse map here to go from Q to the abstract point, and then the forward map to get to the new coordinates. Now, luckily, well, by construction, actually, we have that since these are two diffeomorphisms, the whole thing is going to be a diffeomorphism, and we can just shortcut in this way. So when we do a coordinate change of coordinates, what's underlying is really two maps, even though we will just in practice work with one of them. So the change of coordinates is actually just a map from Rn into Rn, but because it's a concatenation of these two maps, the inverse chart and then the forward of the other chart. Okay, so if this chart is called alpha and that chart is called beta, then the change of coordinates map, phi, is given by alpha inverse. Maybe we go from here to there. And then we plug the output of that, which is this abstract point, into beta in order to get over there. And overall, this is a map from Rn into Rn. And that means that we get this complicated picture now. What we had before was just the right-hand side of it. Now we're just adding this, a second chart. So all of what you see here on the right, you've seen before. We have an abstract differentiable manifold, and we have Rn. So beta is just a chart, as usual. Every point in the manifold gets a name now in terms of an n-tuple. And then we said, OK, here's a point S. We have the algebra of function germs about the point S. And this signifies that algebra. Just like we have an algebra of function germs around that point P, except that this thing is abstract, that one is concrete because it lives on Rn. And then we look at the linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule that act on this space. And that's this set of linear maps obeying the Leibniz rule is, of course, the tangent vectors. And here they are. So that signifies the tangent vector space. And here, same thing, tangent vector space to the abstract space. Now, this is all induced by the chart beta. But what if we have a different chart too? We have a chart alpha as well. Well, then we have the algebra of function germs around the image Q of P under that chart. And then we can look at the linear maps from that algebra of function germs into the real number, which obey the Leibniz rule. That's the tangent space. Around the point, the tangent space at the point Q. And then we have that beta induces beta star, which induces TP beta, the tangent map, and alpha induces alpha star, and then in this direction, the tangent map TP alpha. But also, just by concatenating, we see that not only can we now jump with the change of coordinates from Q to S by just concatenating alpha inverse with beta forward, but also we have now this induced pullback. We have alpha going from here to here, alpha star going from here to here, beta star from there to there. So overall, we get a map phi star that's induced by phi, which goes in this direction. It's beta star inverse, alpha star forward. And with the tangent maps, the same thing. They can be concatenated. And we can map tangent vector in here into a tangent vector over there. So both tangent vectors are images of the tangent vector that we're really interested in, which is some physical tangent vector in space-time. These are both images under these induced maps from charts, and they're related by this tangent map, which is just an isomorphism of vector spaces, of course. Just a linear map from, you know, this tangent space to that tangent space. Okay, looks perhaps a little complicated, but intrinsically it's not that difficult. Okay, so now what we have is that every point in the abstract manifold has two images. It has two images with respect to the two charts. So the chart beta maps to the right to that Rn, and we get an image of our abstract point P that we called S. Let me just quickly show that on the picture again. Is it? Okay. So the abstract point P has two images, S in Rn, and according to the other map, it has an image Q in Rn. Okay, and similarly, F has an image, a function germ has an image here, H, and it has an image, it is the image, because the arrow goes that way. The abstract function germ is the image of a function germ in here, and it's the image of a function germ in there. A tangent vector here has an image in this tangent space and has an image in that tangent space. So written out in formulas, that's what we get. The abstract point P has two images, S and Q. And in the Rn on the right, that chart, let us call these coordinates, these n coordinates, x tildes. And on the left, let's call them x's. Because these are two independent copies of Rn, right? So let's keep those coordinates separate. So the same point on the manifold, which we later describe space-time, every point P in the manifold has two coordinates now, right? It has two coordinates with respect to two coordinate systems, the tilted ones and the untilted ones. And it is the map phi, which goes all the way, which is alpha inverse beta, the map phi that maps the coordinates x1 to xn from the left Rn into the coordinates x tilde 1 to x tilde n in the right Rn. And concretely, this is mapping from Rn into Rn. This is concretely a function. For each I running from 1 to n, we get the function of n variables, and it is this one that we just called phi I. So phi I are the components of this map from Rn into Rn. So the phi I depend on n variables, but as output, they have only one number. And then if you combine them, all n of them, then you get the phi, which is a map from Rn into Rn. Okay, and every function germ has two pre-images, which is to say it is the image of two function germs, one with respect to the one algebra and one with respect to the other algebra arising from the two different charts. And in equations, it looks like this. If G is the pre-image of F in the function germ, in the algebra of function germs FQ, and H is the pre-image of F in the algebra of function germs around the point S, with respect to the other chart. Then, and this is important, then we have that the value that f takes at the point p, the amplitude, so to speak, of that function germ is the same number as is, so f of p is a number, the same as the number g of q, same as the number of h of s, by construction. Okay? And we don't need to put bars over that because, remember, a function germ is an equivalence class of functions that agree in their output values in some open neighborhood around that point. Which means, in particular, that all functions in one function germ, in one equivalence class, all of those agree on their amplitude at the point in question, at the central point in question, right? So when we evaluate the f at p, the point in question around which we expand all of this, then that's a certain value that's the same for the entire equivalence class of functions that we would describe by f bar. And so we can drop these. So let's keep that in mind, that the output of the function at the point p is the same as g at q and h at s, which is important, right? Because it could be like the temperature in space-time or something like that. And then whether you evaluate that temperature at a point in one coordinate system or another coordinate system, it should be the same value. And that's all we're saying here. It doesn't matter what coordinate system you use to evaluate a function, the evaluation at a given point ought to be the same. Okay, so what we have is that g at these points, I mean, g is a function germ at its coordinates in its coordinate system, and h is the function germ over the coordinates in its coordinate system, then they have to be the same. If they belong to the same germ, then there's going to exist an open neighborhood for which this is true. Now, so we talked about how every point of the manifold has two coordinates, and every function germ has two pre-images as function germs with respect to one coordinate system and function germ with respect to another coordinate system. And now on the third level, the tangent vectors, of course, two. An abstract tangent vector to the abstract tangent, in the abstract tangent vector space to an abstract point in the abstract manifold has two images with respect to the two charts. And one of them we call eta, and the other one we call nu. So these are elements of the two tangent spaces, one over the Rn here and one over the point in the Rn over there with respect to the two different charts. And now, remember what we are up to here. We want to calculate, we want to recover the physicist's definition of what a tangent space is. And remember how physicists usually introduce a tangent space? They would say they consist of all those vectors which have a certain transformation property. Right? That's why we did this with the two coordinate systems. Okay, so by construction of all of these concatenations, the remember when you have a map in this way, then it induces a map in that direction, and that induces a map in that direction, right? From the diffeomorphism to the algebra homomorphism to the tangent map. Because of that construction, what we have is that if you apply a tangent vector to a function germ with respect in one coordinate system, you get the same value, the same number, as if you did it abstractly, where you have the abstract tangent vector applied to an abstract function germ, or if you did it with respect to the other coordinate system, where you have the image of this tangent vector and the image of this function germ, if you evaluate that tangent vector on that function germ. Again, same number. Right? So in particular, what this means is that eta of g explicitly, remember this is happening in Rn here, right? Because this is the map, this is the image of what goes on abstractly in one of the charts. And that's the image of what goes on abstractly in the other chart. But we know how things look like in Rn. We proved that tediously. So in particular, we know that any tangent vector to a point in Rn takes this form. Remember, that was the difficult part to prove, that every tangent vector takes that form. Every linear map from function germs into real numbers that obeys the product rule, the Leibniz rule, has this particular form. It's the weighted sum with some coefficients of the partial derivatives. So our eta definitely has this form. And this thing acts on a function germ, and that is to be evaluated at the point in question where we look at the tangent space. And I don't put the bar here because it doesn't matter. And that is the same value as if we did this in the other image, right? With respect to the other chart. Now we have a tangent vector, again, to a point in Rn. We know it has to have this form. And now with respect to the other coordinates, the extended coordinates, and this thing acts on a function germ. Here we have it. And then we have to evaluate that at the point in question. And remember that the value of the function over these coordinates is the same as the value of the other image function over its coordinates. Right? That was this thing that whether you describe a temperature curve in one coordinate, the temperature distribution in one coordinate system or another one, it's got to be the same. That's what we achieved by using this pullback. Okay, so this is actually the same as that. You just have to make sure that you're transforming the coordinates right. So that means we can write here, instead of the h, we can write the g of x. But if we do that, then we have a bit of a mismatch, because we have that these are derivatives with respect to the x tildes. But this g depends on the x's, which are functions of the x tildes. Okay, so we just carry this forward, and we carry that forward, but we get the chain rule factor here. D by dx tilde j becomes d by dxk, dxk by dx tilde j. Right? So we get this Jacobian here. And now we are in business again, because these derivatives act on these coordinates. Right, so this is going to be true for all tangent vectors, eta nu, and for all function germs, g and h. So what we have then is that maybe I should show the whole thing here. Because this needs to be true for all of the g, whatever we put here, whatever we put there, we must have that this is equal to that. So we have that this must be that. But these derivatives are independent. See, they're linearly independent. You can't write d by dx1 as a linear combination of d by dx2 and d by dx3 and so on. So therefore, what we can conclude is we can basically drop these and then say, aha, these guys have to be equal to those guys. And that means that the eta I coefficients have to be related to the new j coefficients through this Jacobian matrix. And the Jacobian matrix is obtained by taking the diffeomorphism that runs from the chart alpha to the chart beta. You take its inverse, and then you take the derivative of that. Or you first take the derivative and then the inverse. It doesn't matter. OK, so what we see here is that the coefficients that an abstract tangent vector has to the abstract manifold that really is meant to describe space-time, the coefficients that an abstract tangent vector has with respect to one coordinate system, namely eta I, are related to the coefficients that the same tangent vector has with respect to another coordinate system, with respect to another chart, the new J, are related through this Jacobian factor here. Okay, so what we found is, and then we can, of course, invert the whole thing, because if this is a diffeomorphism that's invertible, then we have to be able to invert that matrix, and then we obtain that the new coefficients can also be expressed in terms of the eta coefficients through this Jacobian here, which is just a derivative of our diffeomorphism, which is the change of coordinates. So the phi, remember, is the change of coordinates. It's the alpha inverse beta, right? It's the map that went from this Rn all the way to the Rn over there. So what we found is the transformation rule for tangent vectors coefficients. Okay, so the abstract manifold is here. We have a chart beta, we have a chart alpha, we have a diffeomorphism that runs all the way. And then given a tangent vector in the abstract tangent space to the abstract point in the abstract manifold, its images with respect to the two charts, alpha and beta, are sitting here and over there, and we call them eta, one image of the abstract tangent vector xi, namely in this coordinate system we wrote like that, and then the image with respect to the other coordinate system we wrote like this, and these coefficients are related in this way. So the dx tilde by dxj are just obtained by taking this diffeomorphism here, which is a map from Rn into Rn, so it has a superscript I that runs from 1 to n, taking these and differentiating them with respect to all of the variables. So this is an n by n matrix. So this matrix here, this is how they transform. Okay, and this is great stuff because we know how to handle maps from Rn to Rn, whereas it's super difficult to think of what this actually is if you don't have any alternative name or handle on describing the elements of this set, this differential manifold, or the function germs, or the tangent spaces. But from Rn into Rn, we know what that is. Okay. Right. So this leads us now to the physicist's definition of the tangent space. A tangent vector, and I'm putting here the superscript physics for physics definition. A tangent vector, so an element of TPM, physicist's definition, is a map that assigns to each chart a coefficient vector Rn, such that if we choose two different charts, alpha and beta, and we therefore get two different coefficient sets, then they are related by what we just derived, namely this Jacobian matrix there. Okay? So a tangent vector, according to the physicist's definition, is a map that assigns for every element of the tangent space is assigning to every chart an n-tuple. And if those n-tuples, eta or nu, for two different charts, have this relationship to each other, then we say that we have a tangent vector. We will later see that there is a major deficiency in this definition. It doesn't allow us a certain freedom that's intrinsic to the mathematics of it. And the reason is that we are choosing here implicitly, without usually noticing, we're choosing a particular basis in the tangent space, the basis of the d by dxi, of the derivative in this direction, directional derivative in that direction, in the x in the x1 direction, xy, x3. And in the other coordinate system, we do the same thing. We choose a basis in the tangent space implicitly, which is the d by dx tilde 1, and d by dx tilde 2, and d by dx tilde 3 direction, right? And what that means is that as we change chart, as we change coordinate system, we are implicitly also changing bases in the tangent space. See? Because we are going from the d by dxi basis to the d by dx tilde I bases. It's a different basis. I rotate it against each other. But in principle, these are two different things. Changing coordinate system is different from changing bases in the tangent space. You can change the one without changing the other. You can stick to your bases in the tangent space and change coordinates to whatever coordinates you want. You can also keep your coordinate system and change bases in your tangent space. These are independent things mathematically. And physicists have tended to do these two things together because it arises sort of in a natural flow of writing down the equations. But it has led to a major prejudice, which is to think that this is a good way to identify what tangent vectors are. Because the tangent vectors' coefficients in a basis, in a tangent space, change if and only if you change bases in a tangent space. Right? If you don't change bases in the tangent space, why would the coefficients change? They don't. Right? If the tangent vector stays the same, so we're looking at the same tangent vector, just in two different bases, well then, yeah, it will have different coefficients. But if we stick to the same basis, the coefficients are going to stay the same. So what this means in particular is that later we will learn how to change coordinates without changing bases in the tangent spaces, which means that the tangent vectors will have exactly the same coefficients before and after changing coordinates. They don't transform at all. What you can also do is you can change coordinate system as you please and change your bases in a completely unrelated way, such that it is convenient. And for example, this freedom is super useful, as we will find out, when we want to describe, for example, the Dirac equation on a curved space-time. Then it would be hilariously difficult if we stuck to this. If we change bases whenever we change coordinate system, it just makes things miserable. Basically because, if you remember from the Dirac equation, you get these gamma matrices, right? And these gamma matrices have anti-commutators, where on the right-hand side you have the eta mu nu of the metric, right, in Minkowski space. And if the metric coefficients were to change, you would have to find new gamma matrices. But just like a tangent vector doesn't change coordinates if you keep the bases the same in the tangent space, also for the metric, it doesn't change at all if you keep the bases the same. And so it turns out that by using the freedom to keep the bases in a tangent space the same, you can actually keep the metric the same. The metric tensor, its coefficients are not going to change under change of coordinates. So you can choose your gamma matrices once, write down the Dirac equation and start solving that without having to invent new gamma matrices for every point of the manifold. That's going to be a major advantage. All right, but for now, let's cover that so that we see where it's from and what it means. Now, so far we have two equivalent definitions of a tangent space. Namely, in a chart alpha, a tangent vector, xi, can be represented algebraically or can be singled out algebraically in the following way. It is a directional derivative, and we defined it in such a way that we said a tangent vector is a linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule. Right? And then we can write it down in coordinate systems, and we did all of that. So the abstract algebraic definition, the modern definition is to say any linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule is a tangent vector, and that's that. Whereas physics definition would be it is a direction vector, and we recognize it as a tangent vector if under a chart change, under change of chart, it transforms in a particular way, assuming that we change bases as we change chart. That we always use the basis in the tangent space that comes with the coordinates. Now, you have some coordinates, x prime, x prime 1, x prime 2, x prime 3, then a basis in your tangent space will be the d by dx1 prime, d by dx2 prime, d by dx3 prime, and so on. If you always choose the basis that comes with your coordinate system, yeah, then you can use the physicist definition. But we don't want to choose that basis. Okay, now the third definition of tangent space is the geometric definition, which is in a way the most intuitive definition. It's literally going back to what a tangent is. Okay, so the idea is the tangent vectors ought to represent literally the tangents through trajectories. The tangents to trajectories which run through the point in question. So imagine this is our manifold M again. This is the point P that we're interested in. I mean, we're interested in its tangent space. Then imagine that this black line here is a trajectory that you're traveling through this space. And let's say when the trajectory's parameter is zero, then that's when the trajectory passes through the point P. Then intuitively speaking, the trajectory is going to have some velocity at this point. And that's what we would intuitively think of as a tangent vector, a velocity vector, right? So let's formalize that. Let us consider paths in the manifold which run through the point P. So our path is a map from R, which you can think of as a time parameter or just some abstract parameter. It maps R, some parameter, into the manifold. Okay, so for small values of R, for negative values of R, we might be over here, and then as R runs through zero, we run through the point P, and then for large R, we go out on our way. So we want gamma to be the path, to be a map from R into M, and gamma of zero is chosen to be P, the point of the manifold. Now, let us further consider that on this manifold, we have some function living. Let's say the temperature function that tells us, you know, this is like space and, or space-time, and we have a function f, which when you evaluate it at some point, gives you the temperature at that point. Now, as you travel through the manifold, you will experience the ambient temperature changing. Wherever you are, you experience a different temperature. And we can now concatenate the two functions. We can now look at the temperature as a function of time. As I travel along the path, I experience a temperature. So the time is the input to this function, and the temperature is the output to this function. And here it is, this function. It's the path, which takes as input the time, as output the point of the manifold, and that point of the manifold, remember the little circle, gets input into the function f, which is our temperature function, and that outputs then a number. Okay, so this is a function from time to temperature, so from R into R. All right, so the function f after gamma maps time into temperature. And you need a given path for this, right? So for every path, you get a temperature as a function of time curve. Now, we define two differentiable paths, gamma A and gamma P, gamma A and gamma B, which both run through the point P at time zero. We declare two of those paths equivalent for our purposes at the point P. We declare them to be equivalent if, for all temperature functions, we have that the temperature as a function of time curve, so here's the path, and then here the temperature, if we differentiate it with respect to the time, at time equals zero, so this is the rate of change of the temperature as we run through the point P, if that is the same for both paths. Okay? Now, intuitively, this is if both paths go through the point P in the same direction. Right? If they go in the same direction, the paths might be completely different. But when they go through P, they are parallel, right? If they are pointing in the same direction at the point P, well, then the rate of change of temperature is going to be the same at that point. Okay? So this is just a mathematical way to express the idea that two curves are parallel at a point. Right? It's just to say that gamma A and gamma B are considered to be equivalent, and that will translate into parallel, are considered to be equivalent if, for all temperature functions, we have that the rate of change of temperature along the one path is the same as the rate of change of temperature along the other path at time t equals 0, which is to say when they pass through the point P. So the intuition is that two paths, gamma A and gamma B, are therefore equivalent if they have the same velocity. That's just the intuition for it, but that's the math of it. Right, and then we can define, that will be the geometric definition of the tangent space. We can define the tangent space, the space of tangent vectors at P, as the set of equivalence classes of differentiable paths through P. Right, so you have one path, and it has a certain velocity at P. It's going to be equivalent to all other paths that have the same velocity at P, but not equivalent to paths that have a different velocity at P. It's literally to say two paths are equivalent if they have the same tangent. It's just that we can't use that because we are about to define tangent. Right? So we have to define it in this indirect way through this temperature function here. So let's see, are tangent vectors defined geometrically equivalent to tangent vectors defined algebraically? Or could it be that we are defining two different animals here? So TPM geometric needs to be compared with TPM algebraically defined. And they are equivalent. Let's see. Let's pick a path gamma. And then this path gamma through the point P at time t equals 0 defines a linear map, gamma bar. Okay, so gamma is a path. It's a function from time into locations. Gamma is a path, but gamma bar is going to be a linear map. How are we going to define that? Well, that linear map, and you see where this is going, right? Tangent vectors algebraically defined are linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. Right? But here, in the geometric definition, a tangent vector is an equivalence class of paths. So we need to relate equivalence classes of paths to linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. Okay, so we have a path, or an equivalence class of paths. And now, what kind of linear map obeying the Leibniz rule could they correspond to? So we have this path gamma, and now we define gamma bar to be the following linear map. It takes a function germ, like a temperature function, and maps it into R in the following way. You compose the path with the temperature function and differentiate at time t, with respect to t at time t equal to 0, which is to say at the point P in question. And that gives you a number, right? So in this way, what we obtain is that for every path, we obtain a linear map which takes function germs, namely these f's, and maps them in this way into real numbers. So what we have to check now is that these linear maps, gamma bar, obey the Leibniz rule, which obviously they do because the d by dt does. But you just have to write it out. So gamma bar of fg, where these are two functions or function germs, is given by d by dt, f times g, after gamma. But of course, what is that? The product of two functions at a point is, of course, the product of each function evaluated at each point. And then we get the Leibniz rule for the derivative with respect to t. So we get these two terms. And then we recognize that this is exactly the Leibniz rule that is required for the algebraic definition of tangent spaces. And therefore, every gamma bar that we get from a geometrically defined tangent vector, namely a path or an equivalence class of paths, gives us an element of the algebraic, algebraically defined tangent space. Now, you can also prove the other way around, that if you have an algebraically defined tangent vector, then it defines a path, an acronym class path for you, but let's not be so fuzzy about these things. Okay, so far we have the tangent space to a point. What about the cotangent space? The cotangent space will be to a point P will be denoted by TPM star. Now let's remember what a dual vector space is. Is everybody familiar with dual vector spaces? Yes, that's great. Okay, let me just to make sure very briefly remind you of it. Given an n-dimensional vector space V, any n-dimensional vector space V, this could be a vector space of differential equations, for example, or differential operators, or whatever you want. So you take an n-dimensional vector space V, and then you consider the linear maps, which take as input one of these vectors and as output a real number. Okay, so we are looking now at the linear maps from our vector space into the real number, into the real numbers. Then this set of linear maps is itself going to form a vector space because you can add them and you can multiply them with real numbers and so on. And that is going to be called the dual vector space and denoted by V star. And one beautiful feature of this is that the bidual, the dual of the dual space, is canonically the same as the vector space that you started with. Which is why when you in quantum mechanics have a ket vector and then you go to the Bra vector, the dual of a Bra is a ket again. All right, so now in this case here, the dual vector space to the tangent space is called the cotangent space. It's as easy as that. So the cotangent space, just to spell it out again, consists of linear maps. Each cotangent vector is a linear map, which takes as input a tangent vector and outputs a number. Right? This is the definition of the cotangent space. Now, according to that, we can make a quick observation here. For every germ of a function at P, for every f in f of P, we immediately obtain, therefore, an element of the cotangent vector space that is called will be called df. Now, I like that point in this course, because if you've come through physics rather than math, you may have encountered somebody telling you that df is sort of a differential which is sort of an infinitesimal. You have to think of it as something very small or something like that. No. It's just a cotangent vector. Right? There's nothing infinitesimal about it. So let's see what the df really is. We will now get the first insight into what a differential really is, and then in the next lecture, when we go into differential forms, you will see how this is really something super beautiful that has nothing to do with infinitesimals. Okay, so the claim is that for any function, or a function germ in this case, for every function germ, we automatically get a cotangent vector for free. Remember, what is a cotangent vector? It's a linear map from that eats up a tangent vector and spits out a number, right? Okay, so how does a function germ f do that? How can it eat up a tangent vector and spit out a number? How can we use it to define a map from tangent vectors into real numbers? And that map that we can obtain from each f will be called a differential of f and denoted by df. And we do it simply like this. If f is a function germ arising from a function f, then the cotangent vector that we get for free from it, the cotangent vector that we call df, is, well, because it's a cotangent vector, it's got to be a map that takes tangent vectors as input, gives us numbers as output, and he does it in the following way. The cotangent vector df takes as input a tangent vector and maps it into the number that you get when you apply this directional derivative onto the function f. Right? Remember that a tangent vector is a directional derivative. A tangent vector maps function germs linearly into numbers and obeys the Leibniz rule. But in particular, it maps function germs linearly into numbers. So in particular, if we apply xi to a function f, it'll map it linearly into numbers. So this map, which takes tangent any arbitrary tangent vector and maps it into this number, this is what we call df. Okay, so if f is a function, it provides us with a map from tangent vectors into numbers by applying the tangent vector to the function. And then that gives us a number. Okay? So df, an element of the cotangent vector space, takes a tangent vector and maps it into this real number. And it's linear, because if we had, it maps 5 times xi into 5 times this number, right? It maps xi plus eta into xi of f plus eta of f. And so the whole thing is linear. Now, what about that notation here? F is a function germ arising from a function f. But df is a whole different animal. Df is not a function. Df is not a function germ. Df is a cotangent vector. So the terminology or the notation that therefore is adopted is that we say, f is a function or function germ. And df is something altogether differently. It's a cotangent vector. So the D is a map. The D is a map. You feed it a function like f, and when you apply D to it, then you get a cotangent vector. So the D itself, you can define a map D which maps functions into cotangent vectors. So the D is a map from function germs into cotangent vectors at that point. We will see this later in much more generality. And we will see something super beautiful. This D, I don't know whether I should say that already, but I can't resist, I'll tell you. Okay, so this D looks like it's a weird thing, right? We just used functions to define cotangent vectors. Every function, we get a cotangent vector. And we saw, this map D does it. It feeds on functions and spits out a cotangent vector, right? And the cotangent vector does the following job. The cotangent vector feeds on the tangent vector by producing the following number, xi on f, all right. But it would seem that this D doesn't have much of a future. I mean, it's a very special thing here, right? How could that be very deep? It is super deep, it turns out. Let me tell you about a different operator. The word operator and the word map are often used interchangeably, and I will use them pretty much interchangeably. When maps get sophisticated, they're often called operators, or at least when you apply them on like big spaces, Hilbert spaces, and so on. Anyway, so we are looking at D, right? And we will expand its role significantly in the next lecture. But let me just tell you something about this operator here. We just saw what this thing is doing, right? D is mapping f into t star, right, of p of m, right? But what is this thing doing? This operator, as you will see a few lectures down the road, this operator is what is called a boundary operator, boundary operator. And if you take some arbitrary manifold, M, then it'll map it into the boundary of it, which is, oh my God, I can't reproduce what I just did. Okay, something like this, which is just the boundary of it, right? Just this here. Okay? So you take anything, any object, and you just look at the boundary of it. For example, if your original object, like say the original manifold was a ball, then what's its boundary? It's a sphere. Okay? If you take a disk, its boundary is a circle. And so in general, you can just take any manifold and look at its boundary. And this is a purely geometric operator. It maps whatever manifold you have into its boundary. And it has, by the way, a cool property, which is that if you apply it twice, then what do you get? Nothing. It's a geometric fact that boundaries don't have boundaries. Let's test it. Remember, the boundary of a ball is a sphere. Does a sphere have a boundary? No. The boundary of a disk is a circle. Does a circle have a boundary? No. And this generalizes, just always the case, that boundaries don't have boundaries. So if you apply that operator twice, you get nothing. This is not meant to be phi, it's meant to be the empty set, sorry. It's just... Okay? And why did I mention this operator, which obviously has nothing to do with this one, right? I mean, this thing maps function germs into cotangent vectors, and this thing maps manifolds into their boundaries. It turns out they are basically the same. These two guys are basically the same. They are dual to each other. And there's a beautiful theorem that relates them to each other. And it will also be true that d squared is equal to zero, which you may have seen before for differential forms.
Mm-hmm. But the differential satisfies the integral, right?
We are not there yet. We haven't... Next lecture.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Okay, so... I'm introducing the D already. It wouldn't have been necessary to introduce it at this point, but it's the first time you encounter the D, so I thought I'd tell you a bit more about it. Okay, so now in a coordinate system, in a chart, how does this look like? So we have an abstract tangent vector to an abstract point in the manifold, and we have an abstract function germ. Then once we choose a chart, we can look at this much more concretely, and we will have a concrete tangent vector to the image of this point in Rn, and a concrete function germ that represents this function germ in Rn. Then what do we have? Then we have that now that we live over Rn, our g is a concrete function, and dg is going to be a very concrete tangent vector, a cotangent vector. So let's see, dg is what? It's an element of the cotangent space, we claim. So therefore, it has to map tangent vectors into real numbers in a linear way. Now, if eta, concretely, it means this. If eta is a tangent vector to a point in Rn, then it's being mapped into the number that you get when you apply the tangent vector to the function g. That's what this cotangent vector does. It maps tangent vectors into this number. And concretely, we can now work this out because we know that any tangent vector in a point to a point in Rn takes this form. It's the weighted sum of these partial derivatives. And these guys now are applied to the g here, to our function germ. And since all let us remember now that all of the tangent vectors into a point in Rn, take this form. A basis of the tangent vector space is given by the d by dx1, d by dx2, d by dx3, as we discussed earlier. And let me just make a comment here. If you look at this, you may it would be confusing if I said that now. Okay. But we just worked out concretely what it does. Right? The cotangent vector that we obtained from G. That's what it does in coordinates, and we can explicitly work out what the derivatives of G are at the point in question, and then we give this weights, and so we know exactly what this cotangent vector is. Okay. Now, we said that these are tangent vectors. Basis, they form a basis of the tangent vector space. Why again are these tangent vectors? Well, they're linear maps that take functions and map them into numbers, namely the derivative, right? And they obey the Leibniz rule. So they're tangent vectors by the algebraic definition. Right? So these guys are basis vectors in the tangent vector space. And then we can ask, what's the dual basis? The tangent vector space has a basis that we just identified. What's the dual basis? Well, let us look at some special functions. So far, we looked at arbitrary functions f, and we said that if we have an arbitrary function f, then if f is some arbitrary function or function germ, then df is the corresponding cotangent vector. But what if we make a choice, and instead of choosing an arbitrary f, we actually choose a coordinate function? Right? So an arbitrary f would map x1 to xn into f of x1 to xn. Now, a coordinate function does what? If the coordinate function maps xi, viewed as a function, maps x1 to xn into the value of xi. Okay? So it's a function on the manifold which maps the bunch of all of the coordinates into simply the i's coordinate. Sorry if I sometimes switch up and down indices, they should all be up. They should all be upper indices, the coordinate systems. Okay, so let us look at particular examples of functions, namely the coordinate functions, the functions that map points into their case coordinate. So they map Rn into R by simply just taking the value of the case coordinate. Since they are functions, they can be mapped through the D operator into cotangent vectors. What are these cotangent vectors? What is dxk? Well, we know it's going to be a cotangent vector, but what does it do? So the dxk is going to map tangent vectors into R, but how? Well, the dxk is going to map, in particular, the basis vectors of the tangent space into the number that you obtain when you apply the tangent vector to the function in question here, which is the Kronecker delta. So we found our dual basis. The dxk are the basis that's dual to the d by dxk, or d by dxi. Because the dxk is a cotangent vector which maps these tangent vectors into the delta ik. Okay, so we have a dual basis now, and they're these guys. So there's nothing infinitesimal about them, right? They're just a dual basis to the d by dxi. So every element in the cotangent space takes this form. How do we know that? We know that because the dual vector space always has the same dimension as the original vector space, and we already have n basis vectors. So, yeah, so any element of the cotangent space must be a linear combination of the dxi. We just identified them as a basis in the cotangent space. So there's, for whatever cotangent vector you have at your point, it must be some linear combination with coefficients wi of the dxi. So now let's consider an arbitrary one of these, an arbitrary cotangent vector. How does it act on our tangent vectors? And so omega is given by some coefficients times the dxi. So omega takes tangent vectors into real numbers in the following way. Omega takes tangent vectors. This is the most general representation of any tangent vector, because these guys are basis vectors. So it takes any arbitrary basis vector into, well, the application of our cotangent vector onto our tangent vector. So we feed this into that. Okay. Now these are just coefficients, the omegas and the etas. These are just constant numbers, right? They're just real numbers, the omegas and the etas. And because the whole thing is linear, we can just pull these out and the sums we can pull out. So we have a sum over the I and a sum over the J and the coefficients omega and the coefficients eta. And then remember how a cotangent vector acts, a cotangent vector dx acts. It acts by having the tangent vector eating up the function part, right? So we have that the d by dxj eats up the x. Remember the df, how the df acts? Df acts on a tangent vector by letting the tangent vector eat up the f. The tangent vector is differentiating the f. That's how the df acts. And here our f is the coordinate function itself. So the way that dx acts on that, so how do we plug that into here? How do we plug this vector into that dual vector? Well, dxi of this is this applied to xi. Let me just make this absolutely clear. Okay, so we have no, that's not a board. Oh. Okay, so we have that df of xi, this being a tangent vector, xi, df, a cotangent vector acting on a tangent vector xi is, by the way that df is defined, it is xi, the directional derivative vector, the tangent vector, acting on f. And in this case here, our f is xk. So therefore, we have that dxk acting on, for example, let's say the xi is equal to d by dxi, basis vector. We have the d by dxk acting on d by dxi is, well, what is it? It's the directional derivative acting on the function. Right? So it is d by dxi acting on xk, which is delta ki. Okay? So that's why here we have the dxi acting on this. All this other stuff is just linear coefficients that we can pull out here. And then we have that dxi on d by dxj is d by dxj of xi. That gives us the Kronecker delta. And so the whole thing simplifies. And what we obtain is that when this thing acts on a general tangent vector, when this cotangent vector acts on this tangent vector with these coefficients of the cotangent vector and those coefficients of the tangent vector, then the outcome is sum over omega I eta I. Because we chose dual bases, ultimately. Okay, so if we take an arbitrary cotangent vector, act with it on an arbitrary tangent vector, the coefficients behave in this way. They contribute to the evaluation in this exact way. Okay, now for an arbitrary function germ, its cotangent vector, its differential, must be of the form some coefficients omega k times dxk, because these guys are basis vectors. But what are the coefficients? Right? So we know that for any g, dg is a cotangent vector, therefore has this form. But given the function g, what are these coefficients going to be? Well, let's work it out. So we have that dg is eta on g. That's what I just wrote here, right? Df of xi is xi of f. It's just the same thing here. The differential of g acting on the tangent vector is the tangent vector acting on the function g. And that is given by tangent vector eta acting on the function at the point in question. Okay, now let us compare this equation here, number two, red number two, with red number one, which is over here, where we said that omega acting on the tangent vector gives us simply this. So from that, we can read off that these guys must be the omegas, right? Because it's the intersignal product is the eta coefficient times the omega coefficient. So they have got to be the omegas. So therefore, we have that the omegas are the partial derivatives of the g. And therefore, the dg, the differential of a function, is given by the partial derivatives of that function providing weights on the dxi. You may have seen this before also in physics, right? That the differential of a function is given by differentiating the function partially in all sorts of in all directions, and then the dxi. But now we see how that arises. Okay. Here's a little exercise. Let me just skip this. If you're interested in that, this just encourages you to work out the transformation rules for cotangent vectors. And what you will find is that cotangent vectors transform with the inverse transformation that the tangent vectors transform. As a little guidance into how you can prove this. Okay, now some notation and terminology. Elements of the tangent vector space are called contravariant vectors, and elements of the cotangent space are called covariant vectors. And symbolically, one often writes that the tangent vector is this linear combination, and the cotangent vectors are that kind of linear combination, when really there is something wrong with this. I mentioned it earlier. Because this is meant to be an abstract tangent vector on the abstract manifold. Whereas this notation here is assuming that we've chosen a chart. Okay? So this is the image under a chart of it. And it's just that often people just say that's what it is. It's a bit like in quantum mechanics when you write down psi of x and say this is the state. It's not. It's the collection of coefficients of a state in a basis. Right? It's the difference between, you know, this is a state. But psi of x, a wave function, is this, right? And that's a collection of matrix elements. This is a collection of coefficients here. That's the state. This is in a Hilbert space. This is a number. Okay. I mean, I'm not saying this is the same. I'm just saying that sometimes people get sloppy and they don't distinguish the abstract thing from the concrete representation that we get when we choose bases or charts. Okay, now we are ready to define tensors. A tensor of rank RS is an element of tensor space. Tensor space with subscript S and superscript R is the linear vector space that you obtain by taking are copies of the tangents space and tensor them, and you tensor them with S copies of the cotangent space. If you choose a chart, then any tensor of rank SR can be written in terms of the bases that come with this chart in this way. It will be some linear combination with these linear combination coefficients times these tensor products of basis vectors in the tangent space and in the cotangent space. So remember that this counts how many contravariant indices you have, and that counts how many covariant indices you have. Under a change of charts and the change of coordinates, you can define tensors as being all those expressions of this form which, under change of chart, if you change bases along with the chart, so that if you go to a chart with variables x tilde, you would have the new basis vectors x tilde transform in this way. And that follows directly from these just being tensor products and from, as we had in the exercise before, that I didn't go through in detail, the covariant vectors transform just with the inverse Jacobian matrix as the contravariant vectors do. And so you get a bunch of Jacobians one way and Jacobians the other way, depending on how many contravariant and how many covariant indices you have. So in particular, we have special cases. The space of tensors of rank 0, 1, we already knew these guys. This is just the tangent space. So tangent vectors are 0, 1 tensors. And then cotangent vectors are 1, 0 vectors. They have, the tangent vectors have a 1 here and a 0 there. And the cotangent vectors have a 1 here and a 0 over there. Just count how many of each kind they have. Okay, and so finally, I just wanted to make a few comments about a topic that is very important in some areas, such as string theory. But in physics, we don't really have evidence for this particular issue coming up for space-time. But still, let me tell you a little bit about it. So that we are going off on a bit of a tangent now. So far, everything we did was local. We looked at a particular point of the manifold. We looked at the tangent space to that point. But there are many points and many tangent spaces. So let's collect them all together. So we consider the union of the pairs of a base point, which is any point of the manifold, and the tangent space to that point. So we collect them together. We consider the union over all of the points of the manifold. And we give a name to these things. So these points of the manifold will also be called base points. They're really just points of the manifold. And then these tangent vector spaces are called fibers. And this whole construction, the collection of all these things together, is called the tangent bundle. It turns out that it itself is a differentiable manifold. Tangent bundle, if you take all of these things together, it has two n dimensions, because the manifold provides n dimensions. And then at every point, we have this tangent space, which also provides n dimensions. So in total, it's two n dimensions. And this tangent bundle is also called the total space, to distinguish it from the manifold, which has only n dimensions. The total space of the tangent bundle is called has two n dimensions. Now, when we talk of the total space, then the manifold would be called the base space, with its only two dimensions, with its only n dimensions. Right. Now, remember that every tangent space has n dimensions. Every tangent space is simply an n-dimensional vector space. It's a very simple kind of manifold. Just an Rn. And because it's always the same, always it's not identically same, it's just isomorphically the same, right? Because all n-dimensional vector spaces are real vector spaces are isomorphic to each other, we give them a name and we say that this Rn is a standard fiber. It's the thing that occurs in all of all points, standard fiber. But you see, this terminology already suggests how this is generalized. Namely, you can do a similar construction here where you have a base space, a manifold, P, and then you can consider the union of the pairs where it's not just the base points, but there could be other things like the cotangent spaces or other things. You could attach algebras there, at every point an algebra, at every point a Hilbert space if you want, at every point a group or a Lie algebra or a representation of a Lie group or Lie algebra. That sort of stuff comes up in the standard model of particle physics where we have representations of gauge groups. And then we can look at standard fibers that are, for example, the symmetry groups of the standard model. Okay. Now, standard fibers. Right, other fiber bundles are, these are called fiber bundles. Tangent bundle is just a special case of it. So for example, the cotangent bundle is something that we will consider. And then, of course, there are RS tensor-valued bundles when we have tensors other than just the tangent and cotangent vectors. And then there are bundles for isospinners, vector bundles. No, but I already mentioned for the standard model of particle physics, we would want the gauge groups to be standard fibers. And then if we have Lie groups as standard fibers, we would call the bundles principal bundles. Now, consider the tangent bundle T of M. We can project down to the manifold itself. We can just forget that there is a tangent space attached to each point, and so we get back to just the manifold. And this is called a bundle projection. So originally we had these pairs of points and then tangent spaces, but this bundle projection just maps it down to points again. So these would be called the bundle projections. Now, a section, sigma, is a map which is the inverse of such a projection. Now you may wonder, what inverse of a projection? Projections cannot be invertible, right? Of course, they are not generally invertible, but you can have a right inverse to it. A right inverse you can have. So a section is a map from the manifold into the tangent bundle, which is a continuous right inverse of the projection. So what that means is your section takes you from the manifold to the tangent bundle in such a way that if you then apply the bundle projection onto it, you get back to the manifold. Right? So a section gives you, for every point, basically a tangent vector. And you can undo that by just forgetting about the tangent vector by applying the bundle projection. So that's what's written here. The sigma gives you the tangent vector at every point, and then the pi forgets it. So in that sense, you have that the sigma, the section, is a right inverse. It's an inverse from the right. Of the bundle projection. You couldn't put it the other way around. That wouldn't be an identity. You can't first forget and then put the sigma and then think it's the identity. That wouldn't be true. Okay, so remember what the graph of a function is. If a function f maps from A to B, then the graph of it is the set of points of inputs and outputs to the function. Literally, if you want to plot the graph of a function, you're plotting the points which have as coordinates the inputs and the outputs, right? So the graph literally is the set of pairs of inputs and outputs to a function. Okay. And the graph of a field is a section of its fiber bundle. Let's look at a tangent vector field, for example. tension vector field we think of course, as mapping points into tension vectors. So points into tension vectors. And in the chart, what you would have is that a tangent vector field, and that's xi, I'm using the same notation as before, but it means something else. This xi is now not just a tangent vector at one point, but it is giving us at every point of the manifold a tangent vector. And in the following way, you choose your point of the manifold, and then this is the tangent vector there. We are simply allowing the coefficients to be position dependent. And the cotangent vector field similarly can be written as the sum over the basis vectors, of course, but at every point in the manifold, these guys are different basis vectors because they live in different points of the manifold, just like these are different basis vectors at different points. And these are just the position-dependent coefficients of that. And similarly, arbitrary tensor fields are linear combinations of tensor products of these basis vectors. Just keep in mind that at every point, we have a different tension space with its own basis vectors. At a neighboring point, no matter how close, you're dealing with a different tensor, a different tension space with different basis vectors. They may all be written in the form d by dxi, but don't be fooled by that. They're different ones, different, whether you partially differentiate here or you partially differentiate there, even if it's in both cases it's d by dx3, if you do it here or there, it's different, right? So, so this is really a collection of lots of things. Okay, so why then do we consider fiber bundles? Shouldn't we just consider functions over the manifold, vector-valued functions over the manifold? The thing is that things can get non-trivial here. And the point of studying fiber bundles is to allow for what is called topological non-triviality. Now, first, what does it mean to have triviality? Fiber bundles are required to be locally always trivial. And what that means is that our manifold, our base manifold, should always be coverable with a collection of neighborhoods such that for every one of these neighborhoods, the fiber bundle is trivial in the sense that you can view it as simply the Cartesian product of a patch and Rn. Right? You know, you might have even assumed from the definition earlier that the whole thing is just a tensor, it's just a Cartesian product. Cartesian product means the set of pairs, right? So it's just a trivial collection of points and your tensors or tension vector spaces, right? But there is something non-trivial that can happen there. Even though we require this locally to be the case, we want that locally, whatever the manifold is, we must be able to cover it with patches. Even if they might be small patches, but we must be able to cover the manifold with patches such that on this patch, the fiber bundle is simply the Cartesian product of the base space and the fiber. Simply, you know, the inverse of the projection map. So you take whatever projects down to our patch of the manifold, got to be isomorphic to just the patch and then the standard fiber only once. Right? Instead of having it at every point separately. But this is a non-trivial thing, if you think about it. Consider, for example, a manifold that has this ring shape. There's a hole in the middle. And then we can cover it with two patches. One patch U1 that goes like, is bounded here by this bluish thing, and then this is the other boundary there. So we have two patches which together cover the manifold. And in fact, these two patches overlap here and here a bit. And now you can arrange fiber bundles which have the property that in this patch, they are trivial. This fiber bundle is trivial in the sense that it just decomposes in this trivial way, which is to say that the fiber bundle is isomorphic to this product. In particular, there is a linear isomorphism between all of those Rn's in here. And then similarly, this patch also will be trivial in that sense that it factorizes in this way, but the isomorphisms may be different. See, it could be that in between here and there, there is a non-trivial map. Both are isomorphisms, but there could be a rotation in between. You see, if you have a linear isomorphism between vector spaces, let's say this vector space is isomorphic to that one, that vector space is isomorphic to that one, but there could still be a rotation between the two, and that could happen. And that sort of thing happens in the standard model of particle physics for the internal degrees of freedom. Now, it could also be that space-time has holes and handles, and or maybe extra dimensions which have holes and handles. For example, string theory would require extra dimensions, and they might be small, and they might have holes and handles, and that sort of thing can happen. But in fact, we don't have any evidence that nature makes use of these non-trivial large-scale topological issues. I'm saying large-scale because the term topology is also used for the notion of epsilon neighborhoods that we use to define continuity. So this is the other use of the term topology, non-trivial topology, having holes and handles in the manifold. So we don't have any evidence, experimental evidence, that nature actually uses holes and handles for space-time itself. People are looking for it. There ought to be signatures of that in the CMB, for example, but there's no evidence of that at all so far. All right, and then let me just close with a few quick definitions. For the algebra of C infinity functions, we write f of m. So now we are no longer talking about function germs. We are looking at the whole thing at once. And we will generally work with C infinity functions. Remember, differentiable manifolds, if they're once differentiable, they are infinitely many times differentiable. Not true for functions on the manifold. There we have to specify, as usual, how often they're differentiable. Not that we know from physics that the functions are infinitely differentiable. They're probably not. But we don't have any evidence one way or the other about infinitesimals in space-time. Right, and then once we look not at the function germ algebra at the point, but we look at the entire algebra of C-infinity functions on the manifold, then we can show that contravariant vector fields, which is to say bunches of tangent vectors, at every point you have a tangent vector, are the derivations of the algebra of functions on the manifold. Remember, we defined tangent vectors as being derivations on the algebra of function germs at a point, right? A derivation being, again, what? A derivation is a linear map from an algebra, like an algebra of function germ. A derivation is a linear map from an algebra into the real numbers, in this case anyway, which obeys the Leibniz rule. And now our algebra is way bigger. It's not just the algebra of function germs around the point. This is the algebra of C-infinity functions on the entire manifold. But it's an algebra. And we can ask, what about the set of linear maps that obey from the algebra of functions into the algebra of functions again, which obey the Leibniz rule? And it turns out these guys are the contravariant vector fields. These are the tensor vector, the tangent vector fields. Okay? So our tangent vector fields are mapping functions into functions. That's different from what we had earlier. Earlier, our tangent vectors, the individual tangent vectors, mapped function germs into numbers. One number. At one point, it's one number. That's the derivative, the directional derivative at this point. But now that we go global, we have that a tangent vector field maps at every point, of course, a function into a number. But because it does it at every point, it maps functions into functions. Okay, so keep that in mind. This will come up later too. That the tangent vector field eats up functions and gives you functions, which in particular means, for example, you can calculate the commutator between two tangent vector fields, right? Because a tangent vector field feeds on a function but gives the function as the output again. So you can apply one tangent vector field and then another tangent vector field, then another tangent vector field, and so on, you get successively higher derivatives of your functions. And in particular, you can calculate the commutator between tangent vector fields. Okay, so the tangent vector fields are the linear maps which from functions into functions, which obey the Leibniz rule, which is, of course, that the tangent vector field applied to the product of two functions is directional derivative of one times the other plus the other times the directional derivative of second one. All right? And, Okay, so what we will do next is study differential forms. And you may wonder, what are these? You know already from this course two types of differential forms. Namely, the functions on the manifold are already differential forms. They are called zero forms. So functions from the manifold into the real numbers are called zero forms. It's just giving a name. Okay? So you know zero forms already, and they will be called lambda zero. And you also know already one forms. They are cotangent vector fields. Cotangent vector fields are one forms. And that stuff leads us eventually to how do we integrate on differentiable manifolds? What is Stokes' theorem? What the hell does it have to do with this boundary operator? Why is D, that gives us the differentials, why is this thing called the co-boundary operator? How is it related to the boundary operator? All of that will come out from studying differential forms. Differential forms are the only thing that can ever be integrated. Everything you've ever integrated was a differential form, as we will see. Okay, so this is just a quick preview of what's coming up next. All right, I see you on Tuesday then. Any questions? You mean why it was a scalar function? Well, basically, because we got away with it. It's because we don't have to make our function map into Rn. Even if we just make it map into R, we can already define the rate of change, for example, of the temperature. So I suppose it might be possible to do it with more complicated functions, but it wasn't necessary. And you know, if in doubt, keep it simple. Whatever is the minimum to prove something is the cleanest.